Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, a podcast that is dedicated toward bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. I want to thank you all for the love and support that you have been giving, and we're going to continue to go on and press on. And we're going to continue talking about the, you know, very tragic story that is going around the nation. It seems as if new information is being gained and gleaned every single day. And so, it's hard to stay current with this type of information. But we're going to do the best that we can. So what's going on right now is we're going to have a special guest, Professor Seth Stoughton from the University of South Carolina. Many of you may remember that he was on the podcast previously. If not, if you don't remember that particular episode, go back to my episode with Seth Stoughton called Principled Policing. And so there he was on, and he really gave us a good education about the history of policing and, what's going on. Is new, what's going on, and what we see as far as what we see in the video cameras and cell phone cameras and things like that is even new. And I think even to quote him at that particular time, he said, it's not new, nor is it particularly news. The only thing that's going on is that we now see it through cell phones and video cameras. So I called him up. He was so gracious to come back on the episode on the podcast and talk about this particular story. And of course, I'm talking about Ahmaud Arbery, the jogger slash person who may have been checking out or walking through an unfinished home that the jury, I'm putting air quotes up, is still not in at this time. So, but the question has to be, does one deserve to die because they are looking around the home of an unfinished home, right? Does someone decide to go out for a walk into a home that's being constructed, walk around and see the pillars and beams and all this kind of stuff, and then walk out and then continue a jog or start a jog? Does that person deserve to die and or even run away, right? So that's what we're going to be debating and talking about here. I wanted to get his professional opinion. He's a former police officer, current law professor at University of South Carolina. If you go back to the episode Principled Policing, I read over his whole bio. I'm not going to read it again because I read it already, and I want you to go back and listen to that episode again. So before we get into it, just remember to rate, subscribe, and share these episodes, please. And most importantly is to share them, right? If we're talking about good stuff, put it on your Facebook page, put it on your Twitter, put it on your Instagram. Share the episodes through word of mouth, through email. Let's get this information out there so that everyone can hear what we have to say. Also, just as another special note, this particular episode, as well as many other episodes that are going to be coming forward, are going to be videotaped and they're going to be placed on YouTube. So if you want to see us actually have this discussion, you can go over to YouTube as well, Captain Hunter's Podcast on YouTube. While you're there, make sure that you hit that subscribe button on YouTube. And make sure that you are following me on Instagram, CPTL Hunter, Twitter, CPTL Hunter. Once again, YouTube, Captain Hunter's Podcast on YouTube, Facebook, Captain Hunter's Podcast as well. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is the interview, what I'm going to call part one of the Ahmaud Arbery, another look at the Ahmaud Arbery case. And I'm calling it part one because I want the legal professional opinion about this. And next week, I'm going to have a returning guest, Dr. Alan Lipscomb. He's going to come on the podcast, and we're going to talk about the psychological effects of coming of yet another black man gunned down seemingly unnecessarily. So here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Here is the interview with Professor Stoughton, and then stay tuned for next episode when we're going to have Dr. Alan Lipscomb to talk about the psychological trauma. So here we go. Appreciate it. I know we got a lot going on with how are you handling this COVID situation? I assume universities closed down and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, at our spring break, this all hit right the week of our spring break. So the university first extended spring break by a week, and then it canceled the rest of our semester. At least it canceled in-person classes. So all of our classes went to distance learning. Which worked out pretty well for me. I was teaching two small classes this semester, a seminar and a reading group. So it was very discussion-based. So the doing it over the internet actually worked decently well. I'm not sure what we're doing next semester, though. We know we're going to have in the fall semester when we really come back, we know we're going to have at least some in-person classes, unless things take a turn for the worse. But we also know that the university is going to allow students to do distance learning in the same classes. So it's going to be tough. You know, my classes are very, very interactive and there's a lot of discussion, and I'm not sure how to do the in-person approach. I don't know how to take that and move it to an internet format yet, but I have some colleagues who had to deal with that this semester. So I'm trying to learn what I can from them.
Yeah.
But it's a challenge. It's a challenge. My wife is the assistant. Well, now she's the manager of a boxing gym, a Title Boxing Club, and they're all shut down except for just this week, I think, one-on-one personal training with clients. So
they are doing that, or they're not doing that one-on-one?
They are. They're not allowed to do any classes or anything like that, but as of this week, they can open back up and do one trainer, one client, and then the trainer has to disinfect everything when the client leaves.
Yeah. So, yeah.
How about you? How are you doing in this interesting time?
Yeah. I was working from home, so it's not much of a change for me because all I'm doing is podcasting. I put together, just trying to get my business up and running as far as my consulting services. So obviously that's a little slow. People who want to become police officers, obviously don't have any money to pay, and there's no testing coming up anytime soon. People want to take a promotional test. So that's a little slow. My wife is working from home, so she's upstairs. And so I got to kind of schedule these type of webinars around her schedule because, what she's doing is more important than, more important than what I'm doing.
What does she do?
So, she works. So actually it's funny. She helps people get jobs. She works for, don't ask me the name of the company, but it's a company that helps people who are looking for jobs, who are going through the unemployment process and things like that. It's a state, the state, auctions is off the wrong word, contracts people, different companies off to help them, people get back into the workforce and all that kind of stuff. So that's what she does. She's actually a manager at her particular facility. And so, they shut down, but, still trying to help people get jobs and all this kind of stuff. So she's working from home. They're doing webinars. And actually now they're doing a lot more webinars because they're trying to see what it's like when they get back to work as far as, different clients coming in. They're going to have plexiglass up. How many clients are going to allow inside the building at one time, and all that kind of stuff. So that they're working that kind of stuff out right now. So that's what she's doing. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of uncertainty, it sounds like.
Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. My daughter works at a group home. So she has to deal with clients who are, on the lower IQ side.
Okay.
It's a challenge to find something for them to do, because before they would take them to the mall or take them to the, when it was warm, to the beach or carnivals or different plays or, just kind of different daytime trips. But all that stuff is closed down. So now they just take them out, drive them around for an hour or two and then bring them back, So that's a challenge for her, as far as finding stuff for them to do. But of course that's the management's decision, but it's difficult. And of course they got to keep them safe. And when the family comes and visits these different individuals, they have to be very careful. And if it was someone's birthday or something like that, the family would take the person for the day, but now they can't do that anymore because then you can't bring the person back. So if you want to bring them, that's fine. If you want to take them with you, that's fine. But then they would have to be quarantined for 14 days. So now they're stuck with all these people all the time, family can't come and visit them and stuff. So it's a challenge from numerous aspects, as we can
see. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. My mom lives near me. She'll be 70 tomorrow. So she's watching out for her health. And my 98-year-old grandmother lives with her, which means she has to be especially careful about, not going to the grocery store and stuff like that. So it's a interesting times in all the wrong ways.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You're right about that. You're right about that. So I wanted to have you on because of this situation that we got going on in Georgia. I mean, the hits just keep on coming, as I say.
Yeah.
So I want to get your I think you're the perfect person to come on and really kind of talk about this, having been former law enforcement, current law professor. And I just need to understand what the heck is going on and what these prosecutors were thinking or not thinking, or was it a cover up and all that kind of stuff. So let's just kind of take this from the top here and talk about, of course, Ahmaud Arbery, and he was allegedly jogging, but let's take it from the worst case scenario in that he was walking down the street. And let's just assume, for the sake of any argument, that he was maybe burglarizing or looking into an incomplete under construction home. And let's take it from there. Was he doing something wrong? We don't know. But what's your opinion? Well, let me ask you this first. What was your opinion when you first heard the story?
I turned to my wife and I said, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we were taking a walk around the neighborhood and there is a house that's under construction. And we walked through the house that was under construction. So when I saw some of the underlying facts, I turned to my wife and said, didn't we just do that? I mean, the only thing we didn't do is leave and go jogging afterwards. And that's sort of coincidence, right? That's because I hate jogging. We might have left and started jogging, but we were taking a walk and saw a house under construction. I don't know. Maybe it's me. Maybe it's my friend group. I don't know too many people who haven't walked through a random house that they passed that's under construction at some point. Like, because it's, you know, and I really don't mean to make light of this, but it's a pretty normal human activity because it's neat, right? Like you get to see the house bones and that's pretty cool. So, there's so much going on here in this case, but the first thing that stuck out to me is what gave rise to the assumption that Arbery, who had walked out of a house that was under construction, was now jogging through the neighborhood, that he was up to no good. And I don't know, right? I mean, I can speculate. I certainly have some theories. I can guess. But his behavior looks very similar to behavior that I've engaged in and that a bunch of people I know have engaged in. So I think that's sort of the first thing to focus on, is why did that strike anyone as suspicious? And then if it did strike someone as suspicious, what gave rise to the response? Why did the individuals arm themselves and follow him? My understanding is that at least one of them also called the police, but why go beyond that? Why arm themselves and follow him? What gave rise to the confrontation and the deadly shooting? And then we have the stuff after the incident itself, namely the prosecutor's decision to initially clear the individuals of wrongdoing. Because from my understanding, and I realize I'm just like word vomiting here, I apologize.
No.
the prosecutor, from my understanding, the local prosecutor didn't just say, we're not going to charge these men initially. He said they didn't do anything wrong. There was... I believe the phrase was firsthand probable cause, and they were completely justified in their actions. So what's going on there? And now, of course, when the video comes out, we have the Georgia Bureau of Investigation tasked with investigating this incident, and their conclusion, or at least their what I've seen in the news so far, because I don't have any inside information on this, was they said, we didn't have a whole lot of trouble figuring out there was probable cause to arrest the guys who killed Arbery. So there's clearly a disconnect between that first prosecutor's decision and the ultimate decision to arrest and initiate what looks like it's going to be a prosecution of the individuals. Whew, so there's a lot. I mean, wherever you want to start, we can start. It's horrific.
So let's start with, let's try to understand what we went through. This is a human nature type of thing. I read an article, and I actually reached out to the, and I just read it today, as a matter of fact. I read an article, and it was in The Atlantic. And it talked about the coronavirus. I think the name of the article is something like, the coronavirus was a big deal until Trump realized who was dying, or something along those lines. So we talked about the coronavirus. But then the author also talked about the social contract of the presumption of innocence, essentially, around white bodies versus black bodies. And the author went on to obviously talk about this case. He talked about Trayvon Martin. He talked about Tamir Rice. So let's talk about what you did, you and your wife did, when you were on this walk. And I don't know if I've ever walked inside, but I certainly have walked up the houses, peeked in windows. And this presumption that African Americans are just simply up to no good. Try to analyze. I know you're not a psychologist, but try to analyze what the heck these good old boys were thinking when they saw this.
Yeah. So I'm not a psychologist, and I haven't stayed in a Holiday Inn Express recently.
Nor have I played one on TV.
I do, in my academic work, I have done a little bit of reading in some of the areas of psychology that are most pertinent to police interactions and regulation, right? So we might talk for just a second about implicit associations or implicit biases, as they're called. Before we do, I guess I want to take a half step back, if that's all right, and just sort of say something about racism generally, or at least types of racism.
Okay. Absolutely.
All right. And I will also preface, like, this is what I get to do now as a lawyer and law professor. I get to spend a lot of time telling you what I'm not going to tell you. I am not a scholar of race or race dynamics. I am a policing scholar. And of course, that has some obvious implications for race and dynamics of race. But there are folks who know a whole lot more than I do. So what I'm giving is at best a bare bones introduction. There are at least three different types of racism that we need to pay attention to. One of which is conscious racism, and this is the easy one. This is someone who has a particular animus towards a group of people based on whatever, skin color, gender, national origin, religion. But it's a very conscious, I don't like X people. And that person might have exceptions. Oh, you're okay. You're not like the rest of that group. But their general conscious racism is, I don't like this group as a default group, right? Then there's implicit bias. And this is, in many ways, this is the far more troubling type of racism. There we are aware of our conscious biases. We're not aware of our implicit biases. Implicit biases happen below the level of conscious thought. It's kind of like wearing glasses. I used to wear glasses, and sometimes I would be looking around going, where are my glasses? And I'd forget that I was wearing my glasses, right? Implicit biases and associations are like wearing glasses that you don't even realize you're wearing. They shape your vision. They shape all of the information you get from the world. They change your perspective tremendously, or they affect your perspective tremendously, but you're not aware of it because you're literally looking through this lens that's in your brain. And there are some gender and race and socioeconomic class aspects to these implicit biases. So let me give you an easy example. If someone walks up to you and says, excuse me, your response whole bunch of factors that you're not going to have to ever consciously think about. Is the person in a business suit walking down the street next to you? Or are you an employee at a store back when people could still go to stores and they're maybe asking for help? Or do they appear to be a homeless person near a shelter? You're going to respond differently in those situations. In all of the situations, you don't know why the person is approaching you yet, right? You're going to make a judgment about why they're approaching you based on this information that your brain is processing that you're not even consciously aware of. In other words, your brain is implicitly associating a set of facts with a particular conclusion. You might avoid, not speak to, look away from the homeless person, where you wouldn't do that with the guy in the business suit, and you wouldn't do that while you were at work and it was a customer. Unfortunately, there are race and gender and class dimensions to those implicit associations. So we know that most people exhibit something called the black crime bias, or that it has been referred to as the black crime bias, where all other things being equal, they're more likely to view a black person in any given situation as more suspicious than a white person. There's a black male bias where we tend to view black men as being physically larger than they actually are. There was a fascinating study a couple of years ago where respondents were shown pictures of black men and asked to pictures of men, black and white, and asked to estimate their size. And they overestimated the physical size of the black men, right? And that's interesting and important because we know that physical size is how we calibrate our perceptions of danger. How dangerous is someone? Well, that in large part, that's going to depend on how big they are, right? So we have all of these little connections. And what that means is sometimes we in society are going to view black people as suspicious in situations that we would not view white people as suspicious. For example, we had the graduate student who was sleeping in a common room in her dorm, whatever that was, 7 or 8 months ago.
Right.
And someone called the police about that because that's suspicious. I'd hazard a guess that if it was a young white woman instead of a young black woman, that phone call to the police probably would not have been made. We had the couple of young black businessmen in a Starbucks who were waiting, I think, for someone else to join them and hadn't ordered anything yet. And they were asked to leave because they were viewed in some way, shape, or form as suspicious. And I doubt that I would have been asked to leave in the same circumstances. Now, that might be because the individual who called the police in either case was consciously racist and did not like black people. But I think it's more likely and it's more problematic when that results from implicit bias. What's going on in this situation? That person is black, therefore this situation is inherently more suspicious and they're more likely to be engaged in wrongdoing. So when you see someone walk out of a home that's under construction and start running away, you could think, they must have been checking out this home that's under construction because that's a neat thing to do. And now they're continuing their walk or their jog through the neighborhood. Or you can think they must have been up to no good. And unfortunately, while race won't always control which conclusion people come to, the idea of implicit associations is that it might push us towards one or the other. The third type of racism is systemic racism, and that's something that we could probably save for a different discussion.
Sure.
But it's an even bigger overarching issue. But implicit bias, I think, may help explain the perception that Ahmed Arbery was a burglar. Up to no good when he just walked out of the house that was under construction.
Sure. And I wrote down, as you were going through that, and thank you for that. It was very, very well said, very well put. is this idea of belonging, right? Belonging in certain places and spaces, right? You talked about the Yale student who was sleeping, the gentleman who were at Starbucks, and there's this mindset of belonging. And maybe this kid, it's you know, we don't have all the facts there. We'll put that out there for this Arbery case. We don't have all the facts. They're still coming in, but he may have not belonged in that neighborhood or been seen in that neighborhood. Or there's a question of how many times he's actually jogged through or worked out in the neighborhood. And maybe the people or the former police officer, McKenzie, what is his last name?
McMichael.
McMichael. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this idea of, again, tying this idea of implicit bias with belonging, who belongs in certain places and spaces and why are you here? So that's really, really problematic. And that's one that really, and you're right. When you look at all these different types of implicit or implicit, explicit conscious biases, the one that really has to be conquered is the implicit one. Because as long as people have this black crime bias, black male bias, this idea of who belongs where and when is really the most destructive thing, because that allows people to give cover to the more explicit forms of racism.
Yeah, and you're right about the comment about belonging. And there are a couple of really important issues there, right? One, did he belong in, it's not some objective question, right? It's not, did he belong according to the ultimate design of the universe or your religious beliefs, or was he perceived as belonging by the folks who were perceiving him there? That's the idea of belonging is, I really don't like to use the phrase a social construct, because it's even more academic-y than I've already been talking about. But that sense of social construct, it is something that is created by everyone involved. And there's nothing wrong with jogging through a neighborhood, even if you don't live in the neighborhood. So we could say, legally, did he belong? Yeah, of course he did. Important question is, was he perceived as belonging by the individuals who saw him there, right? Same thing with the graduate student at Yale and the guys in Starbucks. Why were they perceived as not belonging? And then there's one more issue on top of that. Let us assume that someone does perceive them as not belonging in some way. Why do they feel empowered to react the way that they do, right? We've all perceived people as not acting right or not belonging in some situation. That might be someone who's talking on the phone during a movie or, any normal circumstance where someone is being socially annoying in some way. And most of us don't call the police. Most of us don't grab a weapon and intervene. So not only do we have to ask the question of why was there a perception that Arbery didn't belong, we might also ask why was there the perception that these folks were in the right to, the McMichaels were in the right to respond the way that they did. And there are some racial implications to that too, right? It's not comfortable, but it is true. When we interact with people, kind of like the example of the homeless man and the guy in the business suit earlier, when we interact with people, we rely on 1,000 little clues to help us figure out how much deference to give the other person at any given time, right? So right now you and I are having a conversation, a somewhat weird one because it's over the internet and I have bright blue headphones, but we're having a conversation. So you talk, I listen, and then I talk, you listen, and we exchange that deference. I defer to you, you defer to me, back and forth, right? When I talk to my dean, there's a little bit different deference. I defer a little bit more. When I talk to my students, I defer a little bit less, and they defer a little bit more to me, right?
Right.
So that idea of deferring, that power that we're exercising in that interaction depends on, well, our perceptions of how much we should defer to the other person and how much they should defer to us. And that also depends on our perceptions of race and class and gender. Often for unconscious reasons, but I use the example of the Sandra Bland traffic stop. I think it's a very powerful example where I don't think the trooper in that case would have talked the same way to me in a business suit in a newer model car that he talked to Sandra Bland, a younger black female driving an older model car.
Right.
I don't think race is the only thing in play there, but I do think it's a really important part. He was expecting her to defer a lot more to him in a way that he probably would not have expected me to defer to nearly the same extent.
Right.
So in the Arbery case, why did the individuals expect the type of deference that would allow them to feel empowered to arm themselves and physically intervene, as opposed to, for example, calling the police and maybe following and keeping him in sight?
Right. And so I think there's two things that, I mean, neither one of us, as I mentioned, are psychologists, but there's two things that I think are very interesting. One is the fact that the father in this situation was a former law enforcement officer. And so that, speaking to your idea of deference, you know, he felt emboldened and empowered to do what he did because of his connections that he probably still had with law enforcement and the district attorney's office in which he also worked. And his white maleness, you know, put those two things together and you get this toxic mix of machismo that just ran wild and caused him and his son to grab shotguns and a 357, as well as the third individual who more than likely was, you know, videotaped the whole interaction. And we can hear the guy, it sounds like to me, racking the gun while he's driving to the scene. This is just, I don't even know what the word is. It's bananas. It's crazy. It's, how do you even explain this? I know we're doing the best we can to try to explain what was going on in these guys' minds to say to themselves, we have this right, we have this authority. Here's a guy who doesn't belong. He's probably up to no good. And we have this right to posse up and go get this guy. Many people have been calling this a modern day lynching. Would you agree with that?
So, I don't know that I would go that far, because in what may be an abundance of optimism on my part, I don't think the McMichaels were going out with the intention originally of killing Arbery. Obviously that happened, but I don't think they were going, I think in their own heads, and I'm speculating wildly here, right? But I think in their own heads, they were thinking, we have to apprehend him, not we need to kill him. And I do think that's a meaningful distinction, because lynch mobs thought that what they were doing was justice and right, and that the courts and the government, the system, could not be trusted. I don't think that's quite what the McMichaels were thinking. I may be wrong about that, right, obviously. But I think they were thinking, we're going to get him and we're going to hold him and then we'll turn him over to the police and we'll let the government and the state do its thing here. Now, I do think that motivating the particular action they took are the feelings of empowerment, entitlement, privilege, if you like to use that word, that said it is our job, our right, our privilege to take up arms and go apprehend this guy. I do think that that is very similar to the approach that lynch mobs had. They did not think, I believe, that they were doing anything wrong. And the McMichaels, when they set out, did not think that they were doing anything wrong. So why is that? Well, I think there are probably many different layers that we can peel back and discuss there. But I thought we have a role in serving justice here. Does that make sense? And I don't want to sound like I'm defending them here, but I don't think that they set out to lynch him or to kill him. I think they set out to apprehend him, although their instincts that they should and that they could go out and apprehend him are probably pretty close to the same as the instincts of members of a lynch mob who said, we should and we can go out and hang someone from a tree, right?
Right, right. Do you think, let's get into the sort of...
And can I throw up one more, right?
Absolutely.
This isn't even the only recent example of this type of mentality, even without the intent to kill someone, right, at the front end. It is a troubling, problematic mentality, and it's not even the only recent example. Where was the other one? I was just reading about it, where a mob of folks, including an off-duty correctional deputy or something like that, showed up at this black family's house because they believed that they may know something about a missing person. And it was wrong house. They were utterly unconnected. You know what I'm talking about here?
I didn't hear about that one. No, I didn't hear about that one.
They just got the members of the group. It was terrifying, right? Because they showed up at this house and banged on the door. And I think the mother answered the door, and they wanted to speak to the son, and she said, no, don't come in. And one of them tried to push the door open. And
oh, wow. And
this is so far pretty damn close to the folks who would go into someone's house and drag them out and lynch them, right?
Right, right.
So we do have issues with anything, any mentality that would really celebrate or support this sort of vigilanteism, particularly when we know that there's a pretty strong racial direction towards who feels empowered to be the vigilantes and against whom they are enforcing whatever standards they're enforcing. I'll see if I can't find more on that article real quick. There it is. Okay. Can I send you a link in the chat window here? This is just the one that I pulled up. So this was in North Carolina.
Okay. Yeah, I'll definitely check that out. Definitely. Yeah. Hold on here. Okay, I can't. Let's see if I can pull it up here. I want to see if the audience can see this.
Six. This is information from provided by Monica Shepherd, the homeowner, who's telling the reporter about the actions of the individuals. It's the sixth paragraph or so.
Can you see this now? I shared my screen. I don't know if this. Yeah.
Yep. I can. There's an ad. The Spike Lee. Yeah. There.
Yeah. Yeah. I keep trying to close all this stuff. Keeps popping up. So anyway, the audience who's looking at this can look at this and check that out. But that's interesting. I did not hear about that. So.
Scroll down just a little bit more till you get to the paragraph that begins, he just said, I'm going to step inside.
Okay. He just said, I'm going to step inside, close the door. This is kind of, said, no, you're not. He had his foot on the threshold of my door, holding the door open, and he said it again. He said, I'm going to step inside, close the door, and I'll talk to you. When I said, no, you're not, Shepherd explained, according to WECT, all this despite there being a graduation sign on the front lawn with her son's name on it. So the name of this article for the audio portion is Deputy Charged with Terrorizing a Black Family with Mob While Searching for Missing Girl. And this is BET.com News. This just happened 5/11. Well, this article was just written 5/11/2020. So I did not hear about that. So, yeah, interesting. Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff there.
And although the results are non-lethal, thankfully, this is troubling, right? This is a group of private individuals, including one off-duty deputy, who set out to do their own investigation, I suppose, using that term kind of broadly, and feel so comfortable and so empowered that they are not quite forcibly entering a woman's home, but coming pretty close to it. I feel pretty upset if that was my house or my wife telling me that story. And the next paragraph has an interesting sentence in it that I just want to read because it will help transition us just from focusing on the incident to the response to the incident. Officers from the Pender County Sheriff's Office had been called in but took no names of people in the crowd, a couple of which followed them back to the house and did not investigate, at least according to a letter from the attorney, the family's attorney.
Yeah. So let's get into I guess we're still continuing on with the emboldening of these people. And this comes from the top, right? This comes from mayors, prosecutors, district attorneys, city leaders who are refusing to prosecute, hold people accountable, and all that kind of stuff. So we get to this particular district attorney, and in fact, it went through two district attorneys, and it's in the hands of a third. The first district attorney decided on the scene there, or what she heard about it thereafter, shortly thereafter, that we're not going to make any arrests. What's your thoughts on that?
So, again, I want to be a little bit careful because we do have to remember that when we're talking about a charging decision, the prosecutor's ethical obligation is to only bring cases where, one, they think there's probable cause, and two, they think they can reasonably prove that they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt, right? Prosecutors are not supposed to bring cases where they don't think they can actually win.
Right.
Let's just accept that as true as the background. I don't know. I'm not sure what drove. There's state self-defense law, of course, that we have to consider here, and I'm not super conversant with the self-defense law in Georgia. But this doesn't look like your average self-defense case. Your average self-defense case, if you want, is someone who gets attacked and clearly defends themselves. I was walking out of the grocery store and someone attacked me, so I did this, right? And yes, I ultimately ended up killing the other person. Or I was working in the convenience store and someone came in with a machete and I, yes, grabbed the gun that I keep under the counter. There are clear cases of self-defense. This isn't one of them, right? The facts are pretty clear, and I would think we're probably pretty clear from early on that the McMichaels armed themselves, followed Arbery to another location, and then there was some confrontation.
And they waited for him. And, right? So they pulled up the street and waited for this guy.
Right. And then initiated as best it, and I'm trying not to rely on the video. I'm trying to rely on the information that I think was probably available to the prosecutor beforehand.
Right.
So if the McMichaels gave statements and if their statements were consistent with the video, and those are two big ifs, they would have said, we grabbed our weapons, we drove down the street after him, we pulled in front of him, and we waited for him to catch up, and then we jumped out and X, right? That doesn't look like self-defense. That looks like, to use the legal phrase, that looks like an aggressor, right? And aggressors don't get the right of self-defense. Now, I'm not saying for certain that a prosecutor couldn't look at that and say, okay, I think it was self-defense or I think it wasn't self-defense. But at the very least, it would appear to me that there is a whole lot of uncertainty about who exactly was the aggressor there. And when that's the case, I don't fully understand why a prosecutor would just say, well, this was clearly self-defense. They didn't do anything wrong, so we're done, right? I mean, maybe it was self-defense, but I would think this requires a little more searching inquiry.
Do you think that this, speaking of self-defense, do you think that this is similar to the Trayvon Martin situation? And how do we, or how does a prosecutor who's going to prosecute this case not have the same ridiculous, in my mind, ridiculous nullification declaring them not guilty in these guys' case, as happened with George Zimmerman? How does someone go about that and defeat that?
Yeah, so I do think it's a lot like the Trayvon Martin case. I mean, I think the facts are sort of line up rather eerily there, which is kind of depressing because it means that at least in this instance, we have not progressed as a country, as a society, beyond where we were when George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin. A couple of the facts that I just want to point out, right? When George Zimmerman called the police about Trayvon Martin, he was told, don't follow him, don't interact with him, right? Now, from the reports that I'm reading about this case, and again, I have no inside information, so this is just the publicly available stuff, when the McMichaels called the police, the dispatcher was saying, what did he do wrong, right? Do you have any indication that he did something wrong here? Not quite the same thing.
Right.
But you have the authorities. Dispatchers are hopefully fairly well trained to gather information and guide people in how to respond. You have the authorities saying either, like, don't do what you're doing, or maybe don't be as certain, don't think what you're thinking, right? So I do think the cases are depressingly and eerily similar. How do we defeat it? I mean, I have an answer, but it's not a very happy one. So it's really difficult when an individual prosecutor makes an individual decision to overrule or undo that decision. You can't sue prosecutors for not prosecuting. They have what's called absolute immunity. They're completely immune from lawsuit. The best that can happen is, like we saw in both of those cases, both the Arbery shooting and the Trayvon Martin shooting, you have an independent prosecutor or another prosecutor, or maybe a state AG who's appointed to head up the prosecution. But that's after the fact, right? How do we keep the prosecutor from making the initial determination? Well, we need to make sure that the right person is elected or appointed as the prosecutor. That's not going to help Trayvon Martin. It's not going to help Ahmed Arbery. It really isn't going to help the next person that gets killed in a situation like this. What it might do is eventually communicate to folks who would otherwise grab their shotguns and 357s and follow someone down the road that if we're wrong, we're going to get prosecuted for this. So maybe let's just call the police and let the professionals handle it.
And that's what's so terrifying to me. And that's the message that was sent out for George Zimmerman and those like him, is that this is okay. I guarantee you, well, I can't guarantee, but the best I can give anecdotally and, you know, and figure speech wise, is that if George Zimmerman would have been convicted of that, people would be thinking twice about this exact incident. And it probably never would have happened if George Zimmerman would have been convicted. And that's what's so scary to me, is that that may have been set a precedent, in that any defense attorneys obviously is going to look at that case. I know I would, and say, what was their line of thinking, line of thought, and how do I get my clients off in the same vein? You know, as far as all the way down to jury selection and all that kind of stuff. I'm going to look into exactly what they did.
And look, that a big part of criminal law, a big part of the argument for criminal law, is we have criminal law and we have punishment to deter people from engaging in this behavior in the first place, right? So why do we punish people? Well, maybe to punish them as individuals for they deserve it or however. But also because other people need to know that they can't engage in that behavior without consequences. So exactly. When you don't have a prosecution of a George Zimmerman, that kind of sends the opposite message, right? That says, like, look, you might as well do this. Even if you're wrong, the way that George Zimmerman was wrong about Trayvon Martin and the way that the McMichaels were wrong about Mr. Arbery, it's okay. You're not going to get punished for it. And right. I'm not a huge believer in using the criminal justice system to solve all of society's problems, but I do think that in this particular context, that's an issue.
Right, right. What are your thoughts on the video being released precipitating the arrest? Nothing was going to happen. People are dragging their feet. Next thing you know, this video goes viral, and now there's an arrest within 36 hours or whatever it was.
Yeah. All right. I have two thoughts on that, right? One, boy, that's true to form, isn't it? So why? Why is that, right? And maybe two reasons, and I don't know for sure which one is which. One reason is the video contradicted the accounts that the McMichaels gave and that the prosecutors relied on. Because don't forget, we have, like, this is not a normal he said, right? Or he said, she said. This is a he said and he's dead. So they get to tell their story to the prosecutor, to the police, right? And that's all the police and the prosecutor have to rely on. It's possible that the video disproved or contradicted some part of that story. And now we have new evidence. And in this way, maybe it's like the Walter Scott shooting in North Charleston, right? Another absolutely egregious shooting. But in the initial aftermath, right, that shooting happened, I think, on a Saturday, if I remember correctly. On Sunday, the agency said there was a struggle for the taser and the officer deployed deadly force. And there was nothing amiss, right? And then the video came out later Sunday or that Monday, and all of a sudden, boy, that initial statement was disproven. Of course, that initial statement relied on what the officer had provided. So within a fairly short period of time, the officer was fired and arrested and ultimately prosecuted. So it's possible that maybe the video contradicted some part of what they were saying.
Yeah.
I think it's also possible that that they might have described everything consistent with the video and still not gotten prosecuted because the prosecutor, well, I'm trying, this may be a family show, so I'm trying to restrain myself a little bit, because the prosecutor, the initial prosecutors made some poor decisions in my view. And that the only reason it's getting prosecuted is because this video got public sentiment up. And now there's political pressure. And ultimately, prosecutors, governors, elected officials of all stripes, they are inherently political, so they're going to respond to where there's pressure. So I don't know which one it is. I don't know if the video disproved something that they said initially, or if the video just got enough people to express themselves loudly enough for elected officials to say, oh, we need to take another look at this because people are not happy with this prosecutor, these two prosecutors' earlier decisions. I don't know. I mean, what's your theory? This is.
I agree with that. I think that I was going to ask you about the poor decision, but I think that the prosecutor down there, both prosecutors, were dead wrong. I think that they were protecting their boy, and they were believing everything that they said. And I think that they were trying to twist themselves into knots into making these sure that these two boys or three persons were exonerated and right. I think that everything we talked about before this whole implicit, explicit, and even, I know we want to save it for another conversation, even systematic bias, racism, this is a manifestation of it. And you're absolutely right that once the video came out and there's enough pressure, enough almost going to be protests, I'm sure that there would have been if we had nothing, had this lockdown situation, that whole place would have blown up because it's what we saw again is, yes, Walter Scott all over again. Somebody's lying. It's Trayvon Martin all over again, you know? And I think that's absolutely right. And that the only reason that there is an arrest right now is because this video is out. The two prosecutors, I want to ask you about the two prosecutors.
Sure.
Well, particularly the second prosecutor who wrote the letter. Did you read the letter that he wrote?
I have not, no.
Yeah. So the letter, essentially, I can send it to you. I definitely email it to you. The letter he wrote essentially is to a captain. I think the guy's last name is Jump, because the captain, it looks like he was trying to figure out, and I'm kind of, you know, going by what the letter is saying. The captain is asking the question, are we making an arrest or are we not making an arrest? What's the story with this? So the prosecutor Barnhill says, well, listen, now he writes this about April 2nd or so, because they had just gotten the autopsy report April 1st. So he's responding to that. So he says, basically, I'm kicking this to another prosecutor, but I'm going to outline everything why I think that this should not have been, no arrest should be made. So my contention is, if you're going to kick it to another prosecutor because there's allegations of nepotism or whatever, you know, conflict of interest, then why opine about why we're not going to make an arrest? Listen, it's out of my hands. But no, he goes through 5 points. And when you read it, and I did another video on this for the audience, you guys can watch this. He went through 5 points on why these people should not be arrested. Well, they could ride around with guns. There's no law, and he cites the law. They're entitled to self-defense or stand your ground. I forget what it's actually called in Georgia, but no duty to retreat act or something like that. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
So he cites that. And I'm like, but you instigated this whole, these boys, these people, these men instigated this whole situation as we just went over. They didn't just have guns on them. As you said, right? If I'm walking out of Walmart and I get attacked, I got this gun on my hip. Okay. I take it out and shoot them. Okay. We can understand that. But they went and got the guns. It's not like they just had them or just driving up the road, whoop-de-doop-de-doo. They went and got them and then stopped up the street. So how this prosecutor, I guess it's an unfair question to you because you haven't read the letter, but I do want your opinion about, if you're going to recuse yourself, why give an opinion?
You don't. I mean, it is wrong to do so. If you are recusing yourself, you are stepping back away from the issue, away from the matter. I'm among the many things I'm not an expert in. I'm not an expert in prosecution policy or charging decisions. I teach criminal law and I'm familiar with the area. I'm not an expert in ethics. I'm certainly familiar with legal ethics. If you're going to recuse yourself, you have nothing to do with it. Because if you did have something to do with it, this is so obvious, it is actually difficult for me to say, right? If you're recusing yourself, it's because your involvement would either create a problem or it would be perceived as a problem. So that's why you recuse yourself. So when you recuse yourself, you don't issue an opinion, because if you do, that would either be a problem or it would appear to be a problem. In other words, you end up in the, as if you hadn't recused yourself, right? This is some like half-assed quasi, oh, sorry, I shouldn't
say that. That's all right. It's all right.
This is some quasi recusal that I just, could you imagine investigating something? Like you're handed an investigative file and you say, oh, look, it looks like the victims or the suspects, whoever, are my cousins. I can't do this. But I'll tell you what, I'll do like the first half of it. No.
Right.
That's insane. They're still your cousins. You still have the same issues, right? You can't, I'll just take it part way. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the point you were making about there's a big difference between having a weapon incidentally with you and getting a weapon for a particular purpose.
Right.
And I have not read the full letter. What I've read are some of the snips in the different news reports, like the first hand probable cause thing. What was the other one? Correct me if I'm wrong here, but part of it was that when Mr. Arbery grabbed the shotgun, that they were entitled to use self-defense.
Yeah, essentially that's what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's just start out as a matter of logic. If you're walking down the street and someone jumps out at you and they're holding a shotgun, what are you going to do? Like, there's no one right answer to that. A bunch of folks are going to haul ass, and that's probably fine. And a bunch of folks are going to say, like, dude, what the hell is wrong with you? And some folks are going to call the police. And some folks are going to grab the shotgun because they know that as long as the muzzle is not pointing at them, it's just a big stick, right? So, yeah, I'm going to keep this thing as far from me as I can. The prosecutor's fundamental flaw, it seems to me, was adopting the perspective of the McMichaels without considering the perspective of Mr. Arbery.
Right.
What do you do when you're jogging down the street and some stranger jumps out at you and presumably starts talking, yelling, commanding with a shotgun? Does he not have a right to do something to protect himself? Has he somehow lost the right to protect himself, particularly given that he had at best walked through a house that was under construction. Right. He didn't take anything. We know he didn't take anything. He was, you can tell he didn't have anything in his hands.
Right.
And unless he's hiding 2x4s and cinder blocks in his pants somewhere, there's really not much concern that he'd actually burglarized the home under construction.
Right.
I'm getting more and more disgusted the more we talk about this.
it is pretty disgusting and pretty terrifying, quite honestly. What do you think are the chances of getting a conviction? We talked about George Zimmerman. Yeah.
Before I answer that question, you said it was pretty terrifying, and that's a perfect example of white privilege, right? Because I'm not terrified. I'm not terrified. I'm annoyed. I'm irritated. I am frustrated. There's no shortage of negative emotions here, but I'm not terrified because, like I mentioned before, my wife and I walked through this house that was under construction a few weeks ago, and I cannot foresee anything like what happened to Mr. Arbery ever happening to me. It's just not really...
It's my reality. It's the reality for my stepson who lives in Florida. For my son, he's in the Netherlands right now, and I don't think they had the problem to that. But if he ever comes back to the U.S., I'm concerned about that. It's terrifying, as you mentioned, Sandra Bland, from my daughter who's 22 and pretty, outspoken. And that's my reality and a reality for a lot of people. I don't like to keep this podcast very racial, but unfortunately, it comes up, and this is what we deal with.
So that is such an incredible point, and I'm really appreciative that you made it, because it's not my reality. And one of the fundamental problems with race relations is that we, particularly white folks, have not realize the extent to which it is the reality for Black folks. That's why so many people, I think that's actually explains a lot of the public focus and the reaction to some of the, both the Trayvon Martin incident and some of the police shootings in 2014, Walter Scott, Tamir Rice, because now we had video. And all of a sudden, folks who look a lot like me, who could never see, could never predict, could never imagine the police interacting with anyone, had video proof that police were interacting with folks in a particularly problematic way, right? So I you know, it is my privilege to not be terrified of the situation that happened here, or of some situations like it. And I think that's important to acknowledge. That's part of that systemic racial tension that we operate under, unfortunately.
Right, right.
So you asked, what do I think the chances are of a conviction? Man, I don't know. Two points. One, and the more important one first, convictions in an individual case are a really poor way to think about bigger social issues, right? Because in any individual case, the jurors are told you have to limit yourself to the facts as they're put forth by the prosecution and the defense, and you have to find proof of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. If there's any reasonable doubt, you cannot convict here. And also, there are jurors who, even if they have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, may say, I'm not going to convict here, right? It's either going to be impossible or exceptionally difficult to convince them that there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So I don't think we should look at individual prosecutions and say, that's a success and a step forward. I think the prosecution, whether it results in a conviction or whether it results in acquittal, is almost an afterthought. And the bigger story, the bigger emphasis should be, I think, how do we keep this from happening again? And how do we make sure that the response, if it does happen again, that the initial response of the police, of the prosecutor, is what it should be? A jury, you know, juries are unpredictable. They might convict, they might acquit. That, you know, don't forget the Walter Scott shooting. I know I keep coming back to it. I'm sorry. But it's one of the most horrific videos that I'd ever seen, particularly given the other context that came out after the video was released, right? You have a guy who is running away. He is 10, 15, 20, 25 feet away, and the officer shoots 8 times and hits him 5 times and pauses before firing the last shot or two, right? And in the initial trial, it was a hung jury.
Unbelievable.
I agree, right? The officer in that case, he wasn't convicted in state court. He was convicted in federal court. He ended up pleading to federal charges. He was never convicted of a state homicide offense, right? So
there were Black people on that jury.
if that case can end in a hung jury, what about one like this where the video isn't as good? Through no fault of anyone, right? But the video quality, the video is moving a little bit more. It's not quite as clear. There are multiple witnesses now who can tell stories that support each other. I don't hold out a lot of hope for a conviction, but I also think that we shouldn't be holding out a lot of hope for a conviction. The conviction is important. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean to minimize that. But as far as like, where does the focus need to be? Making sure it doesn't happen again, and if it does happen again, that the initial response is what it should be, not just that someone happens to get convicted ultimately after the fact.
Sadly, I agree with you. I think I don't want to be pessimistic, but given exactly the two cases that we focused on, the Walter Scott and the Trayvon Martin, I am not optimistic about a conviction. I'm not. I want it. I hope for it. I think that some certain changes need to come within that Brunswick Police Department and the Wayne County District Attorney, whatever, Glenn County District Attorney's Office or whatever. Some different changes, definite changes need to come, but I'm not optimistic about a conviction. I hope that they move to a different location as far as the court settings, and one which is more liberal thinking and more empathetic towards the people, and not geared towards law enforcement in and of itself, right? More conservative types of thought. But I want a conviction, but you're right. I think a conviction would help to deter actions like this from going on in the future. But you're absolutely right that a conviction is not going to change the mindsets of people. And that's what we need to change, is how do we get this implicit, everything we talked about at the beginning of the show, the implicit biases, black crime biases that go through people's minds to where people think that they need to go get a shotgun. We've talked about a number of videos, and we can also talk about a number of videos in which white persons are taken under control without the excessive use of force and all this kind of stuff. And why are we not afforded this same type of leniency and deference and all that? You know, that's the problem that we need to solve. That's the million-dollar question. And you're right. One conviction may stop the next incident because people have a thought pattern, oh, I can't do this, but it doesn't change the psychological motivations behind wanting to do it. And that's what we have to change.
If you imagine the jurors in this case, right, if and when it goes to a prosecution, the challenge for the jurors is going to be figuring out which perspective, which lens they want to look at this case through. Because there are folks who look at this case, I guarantee there are folks around the country who look at this case and say, well, maybe Mr. Arbery should have just listened. Maybe he should have done what he was being told.
I've been seeing that already. It's crazy.
And you know, would this have ended in a lethal shooting if he had done that? No, I mean, probably not, right? But I think that's the wrong question to ask. I think that's the wrong way to frame it, right? What if you were jogging along and some guy jumps out of the truck with a shotgun and starts yelling at you to stop? What would you do? And most of the folks who are saying, well, he just should have listened, are not going to say, well, I would have just listened, right? Most of the folks are going to say, you can't. They can't do that. Now we can add race back in and make it an even more provocative question and say, if you are the type of person who says, well, he just should have listened, let's say that you are the one jogging along and a truck pulls up and two black guys get out and one has a shotgun and one has a 357. What's your reaction now, right? And if your reaction is they're probably here to rob me, congratulations, you have just proved my point about black crime bias. Why would you perceive that if all I did was change the race of the individuals? Well, because I know I didn't do anything wrong. Didn't Mr. Arbery know he didn't do anything wrong? Probably. So that expectation of deference and of the same thing is true. Honestly, the same thing is true. I think we talked before about police shootings or any use of force. Well, if he didn't resist, they wouldn't use force. That's probably true. Not in all cases, but in most cases, that's probably true. But that's only half the issue, right? The other half of the issue is, but that person did resist. Did the officer use appropriate force?
Right.
Did they set the stage appropriately beforehand, and did they react appropriately in the face of resistance? You don't just get to use whatever force you want because someone isn't doing what you tell them to do, whether you're an officer or Mr. McMichael or his son.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on. I've held you for quite some time now. Thank you so much. You have a book out. Is it coming out, or is it out yet?
It is out at the end of the month, and some folks on Twitter are telling me they've already gotten their copies, which is super exciting. I haven't gotten my copies yet, so you have the opportunity to see it before I do. Yes, it's called Evaluating Police Uses of Force, and out from NYU Press. If you order it from the publisher's website, I can even give you a discount code, which I did not pick, but the discount code is Forceful30, Forceful30, and that'll get you a 30% discount on the book from
NYU Press. Two L's? Forceful?
No, just one L.
Okay. Forceful30.
Yeah.
Is that, I try to buy stuff on Kindles and stuff. Is that on Kindle yet, or is it on the...
I don't actually know. I don't think it's available on Kindle from the publisher. It is available on Amazon. The book is available on Amazon. I'm not actually sure if it's available on Kindle. I don't know, Eddie. I just wrote it.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm definitely gonna check it out, and I'll have you back on if you would, and I'd like to talk about it. Yeah. So
I'd be happy to do that. Thanks for having me. I'm sorry it always seems to be in such tragic circumstances.
I guess that's kind of par for the course for the show. I mean, I try to talk about some more upbeat things. I've been trying to focus on more community-oriented events, getting our credit together and in community engagement and being better fathers and stuff like that. But unfortunately, we last few episodes have been about the coronavirus, and now we got this nonsense. And just the last point here is what we're talking about is just this disappointment of what you were just explaining about, what if there were two black guys who just jumped out? And it's just, to watch these YouTube and Facebook comments about he should have just acquiesced. Just so disappointing that, and nobody wants that for themselves. As you said, nobody would do that. Your reactions are either you're going to run away, you're going to stand there and just kind of say, hey, listen, what's the problem? Or you're going to fight. And if you pick the fight, then you're automatically wrong, particularly if you're of my skin hues, you're automatically wrong. You should have just listened. Now, are we not people? Are we not men? Are we not women? Do we not have the same rights to self-determination and to self-defense that everyone else has? It's not 1700 anymore where black people don't have the right to defend themselves, so.
Yeah. But it's tough. Because I can say as a formal legal matter, you have all of the rights that I do, right? As a formal legal matter, the law is colorblind and so on and so forth. But we know the lived reality, that's not the case. It's simply not the case.
Professor Stoughton, thank you so much for coming on Captain Hunter's podcast. Look forward to speaking with you again. Thank you so much.
Take care. Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right.
Be safe.
Love the headphones again there. So.
Thanks. Okay. I gotta put some electrical tape on or
whatever. No, they're fine. They're
fine. Get them to flash or something. They can be
they're fine. Okay, man. Take care.
Thanks a lot. Be safe.